shadow boxing and the Wu-Tang sword style. If what you say is true, the Shaolin and the Wu-Tang could be dangerous. Do you think your Wu-Tang sword can defeat me?
On guard. I'll let you try my Wu-Tang style.
You must think first, right? Before you move.
Tung style is immensely strong and immune to nearly any weapon. When it's properly used, it's almost invincible.
Reality is... And we won't give it a name.
Welcome to Occult of Personality podcast. Joining us once again is Christopher Moores. Chris, thanks so much for joining us. I'm really honored to have you back on the show.
Yeah, I'm really glad to be here. I had a blast on our last show, and look forward to continuing to expand on our relationship and our thoughts on many different things, spirituality, art, music, you name it. Let's have at it.
Excellent. So today we're going to talk about the idea of East meets West in terms of spirituality and religion and those type of ideas. So I have a rough idea of, you know, what we mean when we talk about these things, but could you, for my own benefit and maybe others as well, sort of define, you know, in your own mind, what you're talking about when we say Eastern and Western, and what these two traditions sort of involve, and what their differences and similarities are, in sort of a encapsulated view?
Yeah, sure. I'll just start with... I'll start with my own reflections and how I came to understand that that was part of my own purpose on the earth at this time, was to kind of synthesize those ideas. You know, I, as I mentioned on our last show, I spent many years going to school in music, and in that study, I also learned about visual art and some architecture, and, you know, just basically the art culture itself, you know, the time periods, you know, Renaissance, Baroque, classical era, Romantic era, and I studied the works of all those eras and how that progressed through time, and you know, the philosophies behind it, and even how some of those philosophies gave birth to some of the governing mechanisms that are in place in the Western world. And one thing about the approach that seems to be very Western and is indicated partially by how the school studies go is you get more and more specialized as you go through school. You know, when I was an undergraduate, I studied music, kind of music education in all realms of music, and then I got more specialized into my master's into trumpet playing and a little bit of theory. And then by the time I got to doctorate, I was really studying, like, specifically orchestral trumpet playing, you know, and that was about the time when I came into Zen and some of the Eastern ways of thinking, which meditating on that and beginning to meditate, beginning to find the present moment, I started to realize I didn't fit just into that specific modality, that I started looking at things in a much broader context. And so over the next few years, and probably, well, ever since, actually, you could say I've studied the Eastern way through reading many different books, through going through my own process of unraveling. So you could maybe say the Western approach was to, I was gaining all kinds of knowledge in all kinds of areas. And then as I got into the Eastern approach, I started unraveling that so that I could free my mind up once again. And so there came a time period where I reflected. I was like, okay, so now I've studied this Western art for many years, and then I was drawn to study the Eastern way for many years. Now what is my purpose? What is my individual path? And I could see that it was a synthesis of both, because in myself I had both of those influences very deeply ingrained at that point. And so then the only way forward for me was to, you know, I searched the world, and there wasn't a place to necessarily fit such a immense undertaking into the world. So I realized I had to create. And what was the thread that ran through both was creativity itself. And so then when I created, there were aspects of both of those within what I created. And so that was the way I began to synthesize them. And that's how I came up with the whole idea of the creative cosmos, the synthesis of Western art and Eastern wisdom, which I showed with my work and encouraged in others by trying to put out there a model of that approach, where you didn't have to just choose one or the other, but you could soak it all up and then turn it all back around as part of your own expression in creativity.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. And it seems, you know, to be a uniquely sort of American approach to it, because being in a sort of a place that sort of does that with all things, you know, whether it's spiritual or cultural or food or whatever it might be. You know, we kind of take it all in and absorb it and turn it into something of our own in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really, and that's where the meditation helps, is it gives you the space to do that, where you're not necessarily defining yourself by each bit of information that you take in, but that you get space from the mind, and so then you're able to, from the other side of the mind, shoot through the mind your inspiration. And that's part of where, you know, I studied a lot of jazz music, and, you know, jazz improvisation, that's what they do, is they learn the language, and then when they're playing, they tune into creativity itself or spirit. Like for myself, I don't see any difference between the force of creativity and the Holy Spirit. Like to me, that's the same thing, that which gives life to all things, which comes through, you know, there's like the vibration, and then through the vibration is the life which invigorates things with character. And that's, maybe you could refer to the Zen idea of hollow bamboo, where, like, and I do that when I'm on the air with you right now. I just try to open up and I let the responses or the spirit come through me and find the form that best communicates the message that wants to be expressed, or that is the response to the energies at play. You know, I let it flow out and let that inspiration shoot through the mind matrix, which contains everything that I've ever been exposed to. And so in order to do that, you need to cultivate the witnessing consciousness, or the state of being a watcher, where you realize that the mind is a mechanism, that it's a tool, and you are not trapped within the definitions in the mind, and are not dictated to by that which you've accrued knowledge-wise, but you're on the outside, your space, your consciousness, which can then use that as a means to express.
Mm-hmm. Hollow bamboo, yeah, that's a beautiful expression for it. Could you talk a little bit more about sort of the basic philosophy of Zen Buddhism and sort of what that entails a little bit?
Well, yeah, I can speak to what it means to me, mm-hmm. for sure. And yeah, it's, I mean, first of all, it's not a belief system like many of the other types of religions that we might encounter. And that's one thing that's to get the Western mind to understand it, that's probably the first thing to know. You know, they get very used to like certain kind of like Christianity dogma, for instance, or where it's there's like a whole hierarchy of rules, a whole system of how this works, this works, this works, this works. Well, Zen isn't like that. Zen is actually to be free of those interpretations or those definers, so that you can meet life as it is now, in the moment. And so, and that goes in with that, what I said, that state of being a watcher, where you observe and you don't necessarily define as you go or interpret as you go, because when you interpret, you then kick in your personal lexicon, which then reduces the experience to something which seems to be known. And in so doing, you put it in your own context and you remove the magic or the luster of the life as it is, unencumbered by such interpretation. So, and these interpretations happen on many levels. There's the more basic of where we just see things according to our own experience. But then even deeper, there are things we take for granted, such as, the labels we pick up when we're young, like to differentiate colors or textures, or, well, this is a chair and this is, this and that and this and that and this and that. Then we take those and log those in. And that is also part of the unraveling necessary to have the Zen experience. So, because we need to remove like all those filters, so that we just see, just they say sometimes to reflect, we're like the moon on a lake, the lake just reflects the moon, you hold the moon. You know, and all these things that we learn, at best, our fingers pointing to that moon. And that moon is the silent stillness within, which transcends all transitory phenomena. And so in that state, we don't need to go into all those permutations of specific knowledge, because they are all contained at once within the witnessing consciousness, because all comes from that in the first place. So in that stillness, in that awareness, in that consciousness, already lies everything which manifests in the world.
Yeah, that sounds very much like the first passages in the Tao Te Ching as well.
Well, that's cool. Lao Tzu's a friend of mine.
The Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The unnameable is the eternally real. Naming is the origin of all particular things. Free from desire, you realize the mystery. Caught in desire, you see only the manifestations. Yet mystery and manifestations arise from the same source. This source is called darkness, darkness within darkness, the gateway to all understanding. One of my favorite books, I think. So,
yeah, you could carry that book and that could be all you need if you went deeply enough into it, I bet. So, yeah, it leads me to say that, there's something going on here that, many of us might lose track of because we get focused on externals, So part of the point of the stillness or the meditation or coming into the present, there's a piece there, but there's also something else there. There is getting more deeply in touch with the life force, which is a very real thing. Another of the ways they put it in Zen or in Buddhism is the blooming of the lotus. Now that blooming of the lotus is a real phenomenon, and we as individuals are expressions of that one lotus. And when we open up to that spirit, that's why that creativity ties East and West together, and why I say it is one with the Holy Spirit, because when we tune into that, we can also trace back to the source. Then our song, the individual song that we're singing, becomes one with the song that's already being sung throughout the universe, and we are in harmony with that source. And so we are one, and we are also individual, and we are totally enlivened by that magnificent vibration, by that song, by that resonance that is always there, but we have to go more deeply inside ourselves in order to tune into it. If our mind is focused on the outer world and on the happenings of the outer world and the desires and truly believing ourselves to be the body, and believing ourselves to be the mind, that which interprets the activities which occur in the body, then there's no room, there's no space to tune into that deeper level of consciousness. But it's always there, and it's always available, and it's a celebration of life, which is always going. And when you learn, when you become aware of it, you can always go back to it. You never leave it. It's always going on underneath the surface. And when the sun rises in the morning and you hear the birds sing and you say, aha, that's but another expression of that celebration of the beauty, the magnificence, the gift of life itself. And then the gratitude arises within you, and then the joy springs forth at being a part of that symphony of celebration.
It's amazing. Yeah. Now, when you were studying Eastern traditions, philosophy, it wasn't until you sort of realized that the combination of that with, you know, the creativity and sort of combining the two that you sort of realized your true purpose.
Yeah, I would say and that wasn't something that happened overnight. That was something I really struggled with, you know, because one of the things I did, going through the school process, many of, like, say, the professors will say, well, do it this way or do it that way or try this, try that. You know, it gives you many different approaches, but in the end, you must find your own voice. And so when I left school and dove into the metaphysical studies and into Zen, I went for it hardcore. I risked everything. I left and I turned down job offers and just went out on search. You know, really, Buddha was my inspiration. You know, he left his kingdom to be a wandering monk, because he realized within himself that the search for the truth was the highest calling. Because one day we will all leave here, and what we leave with will be the consciousness, not that we have discovered or uncovered, and not that which we have gained in the world. And underneath it all, really, the point of being here is to learn these lessons about ourselves, and to actualize our potential. And that is what will provide us with the fulfillment that eventually gives us that peace and harmony within ourselves. So I left on my own journey into the night and had no idea what was coming tomorrow, because I had stopped letting the patterns of the past dictate my future. I made a clean break. I made a leap from the head to the heart and had to just kind of sort it out as I went, you know. And it's not necessarily going to be an easy process. You know, I spent many years kind of sorting it out. You know, basically what I did is I kind of went into, I withdrew from the world quite a bit and began experimenting little at a time. And one of the keys that I did was whatever came up in me to do, I went with. I didn't doubt it. I didn't hesitate. I didn't hold it back. I didn't let those voices say that within say, you know, don't do that. That doesn't make sense. Or that's kind of different. That's kind of strange. You know, all the things that come from the world. You know, a lot of the world likes, you know, comfort, safety, you know, the usual, the norm. And when you come out with something new or something original, it startles people a little bit, or it, you know, shakes things up. And you know, some people get it and some people don't. So there was kind of a, but I began just allowing everything to come through and take its course. So then I began picking up the guitar and playing the guitar, and suddenly I realized I was writing songs that just were expressions of this feeling I had in my heart. Or I spent days and days drawing and then observing that which came out in my drawings, reflecting upon it, and then drawing again and drawing again and drawing again, and all these feelings and expressions and things that had been inside began to move. And then it compounded on itself, and then it became a flow. And then as this flow began moving more freely, I also began having realizations, you know, Zen realizations about life, about nature, about my own eternal existence beyond being here. Because when you move these energies, that creates openings, that creates space for things to dawn on you. You know, and that's how you know that spirit is at work within you, when something dawns on you that is not within your predisposed parameters. Something new comes in, something new is discovered, and then you express that, and that is truly a wondrous occasion, because only a soul can bring something new to the earth.
Now, would you sort of give your, if, or say if you were asked for your opinion or advice for people who, you know, rather than sort of come to this state of awareness in a gentle, easy, you know, kind manner, that they've sort of been thrust, have it had it thrust upon them, whether through some sort of mystical experience, you know, whether they were looking for it or not, or some kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, paranormal event that that sort of led them, you know, into that mindset rather abruptly. Would you have anything to say for, you know, people like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, actually, that's kind of how it happened to me. You know, there was pretty, it just started busting loose inside of me all of a sudden, and I kind of had to deal with it. And it was pretty hot stuff, you know, because it wasn't just, I started suddenly seeing the world in a different way. I suddenly started feeling that there was so much more of me to be expressed, to come out, and there was a sense of urgency about it. My Kundalini was awakening and shaking me, and just, you know, my energies were bursting open, and it was a very intense time. And, you know, to some extent, there is probably no substitute for letting these things, kind of find their initial way out. You know, one of the good things to know is it's not always going to be quite so intense as when it first, comes upon you like that. But then when it does come upon you, you could find a safe place to express these things. And some of these things might not just be a picture or a poetry. You know, they might be screams or shrieks or howls, or, you know, just because one thing I say sometimes is don't be afraid of extremes, you know, because so often in the world and in our normal life, we have everything kind of tempered, You know, everything's kind of subdued and under control. Well, to really enliven the energy and allow this force to work its way through you and bring consciousness to the forefront of your life, you need to let it do its thing and awaken all of your energy so anything goes. So you might find yourself a quiet basement room like I did and begin to let it take its course. And, you know, if you wanted to laugh hysterically too, you know, it's not all the darker side, but some of what ends up coming out are some of our repressed emotions from the past, you know, when you open up to them, because really the only reason they don't come out already is because we tend to hold them down. And as soon as you're becoming more awakened to life and you want to free your energy and heal your energy, you got to start letting these things pass through to open up and allow them to come up when they do. And they will. As long as you don't hold them down, they'll come up. They'll kind of bubble up. And then when they bubble up, you give them safe passage. And one of the things to take note of is, though it may seem hard and hurtful at first, when that energy is transformed, and one of the biggest ways it gets transformed is through tears or through laughter, but when it is transformed, that energy will be freed up to the positive side. You recover that part of yourself which is lost. You know, I often refer to this almost as a shamanic-like quality of what I do or what I talk about, is you need to recover these lost parts of your soul, the missing pieces of the whole, and bring them back in and put yourself back together. And you go inside yourself and inside your own past, and to find these things, you open up to them, you heal them, you even take yourself from the present, go to yourself in the past, and if there's even nobody in the outside world to give you the nurture or the kind of acceptance that you need, with your understanding now, you can go back and give yourself that acceptance that creates the release that then allows that energy to come back into you. So that's part of why it's helpful to have somebody who's kind of been through it before, either talk about it a little bit like you and I are right now, because then then it's not so scary. Because if you just feel like a lot of people don't let their repressions come up because it feels so dark, it feels so, you know, like they don't want to go there. But once you go there, you open up and then you pass it through, it's no longer dark, and then also you're done with it. So any phenomenon that happens in time, well, you can know that it will be, once you pass it through, you'll be done with it forever. But until you allow it to arise and be healed, it will haunt you on an ongoing basis. So in my own efforts, when I got that point, I decided I'm just going to do it and take care of it and be done with it. You know, and whatever it took, I was willing to do. And I had some helpful people around me. I had that's part of why in the three gems of Buddha, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the Buddha, the one who gives the insight or the insight source, the Dharma, the source itself, that material which facilitates transformation, and the Sangha, the support group, in a sense, you know, the people who kind of understand and who are also doing that process. And so I think that would be part of the advice I'd say too, is get with other people who are going through that process. And so when you find that other people are doing it, you don't feel so alone and so scared of what's happening. You realize, though it may not be everybody out there, that there are some other people out there that are going through this, that are experiencing it. What you're experiencing is real. Your feelings are valid. And there is a point to it all, which is going to be your own healing, realization, and consciousness, which is then going to be with you ever after.
Yeah, definitely. And that's certainly, you know, one of the reasons that we're doing this, and that, you know, do this show in general. A lot of what you're talking about here, from a Western perspective, in my opinion, sounds a lot like sort of the more esoteric, practice of alchemy. And I don't know, I've probably done this a couple times already, but for people who want to know more about that or curious about what I'm referring to, there's a couple books, Esoteric Keys of Alchemy by Paul Foster Case, and The Emerald Tablet by Dennis William Hauck, H-A-U-C-K. It's The Emerald Tablet. Both of those books sort of describe, the sort of process that you're talking about, that personal transformation or transmutation. So it's very, very interesting to see how different paths sort of lead to, from the same source, you know, to the same destination, but yet they are different in many ways. Another question that comes up is, you know, as people are sort of going through this process, a lot of times they're looking for answers, and there's a lot of people out there sort of offering answers, some of which might be better than others. What would you say in terms of guidance for people in terms of how to discriminate between, you know, what might be good for them or not so good in terms of their own development?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I would say is trust yourself. Trust your own experience. Trust what you're feeling. And then with that as the base, you could go in and explore all of it. And part of the point is not to then reduce it yet to another dogma, right? Not to hold on to it, because nothing that you're going to read or be exposed to is going to be your path, because you are unique. Each one of us is unique, and our own path is going to be our own path. You know, like say for myself, that I have many different pieces of the puzzle that I've filled in with, you know, some of the different books, you know, I mentioned this before, that Osho is a big, big one, Yogananda, Barry Long, you know, some of the Castaneda books, you know, and then I went through and read books on, you know, many books on chakras, on auras, on, some Sri Chin Moy books, out of body experiences, the Robert Monroe astral plane books, you know, and see what this stuff does at best is then when you have the experience for yourself, then you can say, aha, now I know what they were referring to, you know, not to take what someone else expressed and make it a belief, because in fact that's the last thing you want to do. So that's the most important thing to keep in mind, is to you know, yes, we're seeking for answers in a sense, but what we're really seeking is our own experience and our own inner sense of knowing. And so expose yourself to everything, and that which resonates as true for you will automatically have the effect it needs to have. You don't need to, you know, read it over and over and over again. You don't need to kind of hold on to it. It has its effect because it's awakening. And when you're exposed to that which awakens, it won't be undone. And to some extent, you also have to just be patient to let the process kind of do its thing. You know, once it starts happening, if you work with it and go with it, it won't stop. You know, it's only if you do kind of grab on to something and then start excluding everything else that you start kind of reaching a dead end in the path. So I advocate a fluidity. That's, try not to draw conclusions. Try not to, you know, make hard and fast rules out of everything, because there's room for all of it in the witnessing consciousness that exists moment to moment. And if it's all there, you have all of it to draw from, as well as your own inner light as you go forth day to day.
Now, when we talk about these concepts, sort of the idea, and let me know if I'm like way off track here, please. even in the West, there's this concept of the East as sort of the source, you know, the source, capital S. You know, you have, like books like Hermann Hesse, The Journey to the East. You know, this whole idea, of, you know, the East being the source of all, knowledge and enlightenment or light or whatever you want to call it. What do you think of that whole idea in sort of a historical sense?
Well, I think that, I mean, there's some truth to that. Again, to myself, I try not to draw absolutes. I think that any individual can find the truth within themselves. You know, it transcends all eras and cultures and surface skins, you know. That's one thing that we're not, we often think of the fact that we're making progress through time as we go ahead, you know, but we might be making technological progress, so to speak, but spirituality and the truth of realization is the same as it always has been. And I think that even in the West, there have been pockets of this, you know, where somebody is kind of the keeper of the flame, you know, they hold the wisdom, and, you know, maybe some come around them and they pass it on maybe to a few individuals who then try to pass it on, and maybe then it gradually dies out, but then somebody else will be a bright flame and it will live again here and there, you know. So in a general sense, I think it's probably happened all over, because we can't necessarily even look at enlightenment or truth from a standpoint of history. But now, that being said, if we do go ahead and work with the history, much of the wisdom, like the East has kind of made themselves the keepers of the wisdom, and they've probably incorporated more methods of finding that. Certainly in our world today, we see much more of that tradition of wisdom and self-realization come from the East. You know, this is another thing that I kind of realized going into my own meditation, or the people that I'm drawn to. Well, Osho, one of my big influences, again, he came from India and came to America to kind of try to bring the meditation to America. And that was like in the 80s. Now, before that, Paramahansa Yogananda, he's a person from India who came to America in like the 20s and the 30s. And he was also trying to bring the Eastern meditation to America. You know, America is pretty young historically. It's a young nation, and, you know, it's very ambitious and very bright, but it doesn't have the longer current of, you know, the slower sands of wisdom underneath it. And if we could only incorporate meditation, I think that itself will free up many of the problems that we have, because we get so wrapped into ego and so wrapped into, we know everything, you know, we're the best, and, you know, on and on. But if you can just chill out on that and realize the basic human continuity, or the factor which unites us all, then those become a less predominant as a focus. And again, that's moving from the head to the heart. And I think that's precisely where many of the Western nations, if you say, you could say America or even to some extent Europe, it's making that leap from head to the heart, that which seems to make sense rationally, and then going to that which is our intuitive feeling, our deeper sense of knowing connected to the universe, and that which comes forth through that, and learning to trust that, because it's not necessarily scientifically verifiable. How do I know your experience? How can I prove your experience? I can't. It's yours. You know, we can come up with methods to assist in that realization or that experience, but that experience will always be individual. Mm. And so that's part of, I think, what we in the West are learning to trust and learning to stand by or even finding out about in, you know, in a sense. And I think part of that is, you know, that certain religions or philosophies have been so predominant, and to some extent they exclude that mystical. They almost make the mystical side seem dark or evil or something. And so people have are kind of afraid to go there. You know, look at our own not too distant history of like, witch hunts and heresy and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, where the society cries foul even at the sign of something different, mm-hmm. even to the point of where they'll lynch you and kill you, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So, and I think in the East there's been a climate, a much more accepting climate. They've had more people who've attained that and expressed that and a longer tradition, and in that sense they tolerate that which is unusual or that which seems to be so different much more than we have thus far in the West. But I do believe that all the efforts have not been in vain, and part of my own work is to keep that influx of meditation into this society, to keep those concepts moving and to express things in new ways and show and to bind them together, to show that they aren't adversarial. Yin and yang are not adversaries, they're best friends.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's a good point. And not to sort of belabor this, but just so I'm clear on this idea of sort of looking to the East or journey to the East, I don't mean in the sense of necessarily the progress of civilization going in one direction or another. I mean, in specific examples like, the Knights Templar, right? They travel from Europe to the Holy Land, and that's where they supposedly gain their esoteric knowledge. Although I think that's somewhat disputed as well. But you have other more modern examples. Madame Blavatsky traveled to Tibet, supposedly, to learn much of her knowledge. Crowley traveled to the East. And there's many other, you know, people that have sort of taken that journey. And I think the main archetype that comes to mind, especially, and this is sort of the story of Christian Rosenkreutz, the mythical founder of the Rosicrucian fraternity, who journeyed to the East, you know, to learn his esoteric knowledge and then returned to the West to disseminate it. So you're right, it's sort of, we have this very real sort of history, both in myth and reality, of people either coming from the East originally or starting from the West, traveling to the East to gain their knowledge and then returning and spreading it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like myself, that's much like what I did, though my body remained in the West. My soul was kind of awakened by the East, and as I went into my own greater journey as a spirit, you know, as I mentioned, like, people having come from the East to the West, in my own understanding, I believe myself, though I was born here in America, in Michigan specifically, Alpena, Michigan, to get even more specific, the 45th parallel. But I believe myself to be a soul that has essentially been trained in the East, and my journey was to come here and kind of stake root a little bit those ideas here. And it is kind of it's a labor of love, you know. Not easy to necessarily turn back all the momentum that, you know, you're working with thousands of years of momentum, you know, that are breaking around you, you know, and it's in every conversation. It's in all the signs and messages all around, you know. That's why I like to bring out signs like, or symbols like yin yang symbol or om symbol, or, you know, I like, stars or moons or, you know, just things to kind of rally those energies around. Like, well, if that person thinks it's okay to display the yin yang symbol, or that person thinks that there's some value there, then maybe another person can feel a little more comfortable going there. You know, they won't feel so alone or so out on a limb or so isolated in exploring those ideas themselves, you know. And then I think as that picks up a little momentum and there's a few more people, and then it kind of compounds on itself. I think it's really a great movement that isn't acknowledged much going on in America. It's kind of this influx is really kind of taking off, I believe, and more people are opening up to, you know, just such things as the astral realm, or the fact that, you know, when people die or pass on, they're not gone into oblivion. You know, you might even run into them from time to time. You'll dream about them. You'll have signs about them. You know, you'll be connected to them on an ongoing basis. It isn't just over. You know, there are higher levels of frequency, other realms, you know, or, you know, the fact that we have, you know, spirit guides or angels, or, you know, like I like to look at it this way is, you know, imagine your family and friends here. Well, you have just as many family and friends just out of sight on the other side, and they're all loving you and working for you and helping you find your way. And, you know, there's just so much to the universe, so much to explore, so much depths. And, you know, that's the other side of what I express in my work, and why I call it creative cosmos. So we talked about the creativity, but also the cosmos, the cosmic side. We're on a planet in outer space, you know, and we're on a sphere. So really, East and West is relative. If you're on one side of me, you're East, you're on the other side, you're West, but to them, it might be different. Wherever you are on the sphere, there really is no such thing as East or West. There just is you on the planet, and with the stars in the sky and universes all around you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you may have read my mind there, actually talking about past lives and what happens, you know, after death and the astral and these things, because I wanted to ask you also if you are familiar with the work of an individual named T. Lobsang Rampa.
No, I haven't really. I don't think I've really encountered much of that work.
Tell
me a little bit.
Yeah, I've just become familiar. I picked up a book called You Forever. T. Lobsang Rampa wrote, I guess, 22 books, including The Third Eye and The Wisdom of the Ancients. And the story goes basically that there was a writer named Cyril Hoskin. I believe he lived in England. In 1947, he changed his name to Carl Quonswo. He was unable to find work under his new name. He felt a strange compulsion to adopt Oriental ways. He broke off ties with family and friends and became very secluded. And I think it was, June 13th, 1949, he suffered a mild concussion after falling from a tree that he was pruning in his garden. He was unconscious for a short time, but after he recovered, Carl Quonso was no longer there. And another personality, a Tibetan, had taken his place. And this one was named T. Lobsang Rampa, who claims that he had made an arrangement with Cyril Hoskin that he had agreed to willingly, that he would, you know, basically take over his body, and that this was a Tibetan Lama. He wrote these books. I think the one called The Third Eye supposedly describes, you know, scenes of daily life in Tibet and things like this. So, you know, I think this is a good example of one of those things where you kind of have to keep your mind open to the possibility that, you know, it may very well be what it seems to be. And I'll put a link up to this information. This is from a website called educateyourself.org. But, this guy has a lot of books out there that are very, very interesting. And his story itself is even more interesting, I think.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. Yeah, I agree. You know, that's where, when I spoke a little bit earlier of trying to remove the doubt or the hesitation in your own mind as you embark upon this journey, because it will go many strange places, you know, things that you might not have thought were even possible. You know, when I spoke a little bit about recovering some of my own past lives and kind of letting that go, almost, see, and that's where the artistic flow helped, you know, because then when I started feeling like wearing rings or changing clothes or getting symbols or swords or you name it to go along with kind of wearing that back in the present to work it through and reassimilate it, I just went with it. I didn't doubt it, you know. Or, you know, maybe you'll feel all of a sudden like, you know, this place isn't necessarily your original home. Maybe you feel like you came from another star system, and you'll look up to the sky at the Pleiades cluster and you'll think, ah, home, that's where I came from, you know. Or, you know, maybe you just sailed over here. You flew over here, you cruised into our solar system, took, you know, passageway through the sun and came through, cruised around the Earth, started orbiting the Earth. You take a few lives, and then when you're done, you cruise on out of here and you head to another planet, another star, another lesson, another life, you know. And there's a continuity to it all, and eventually you'll maybe remember it all, you know. Maybe you're an angel in a human body, and maybe you're meant to do anything, you know, anything and everything, not that which you were trained to do through school. Maybe when you awaken, you'll find a completely different destiny. You know, this show with you that I'm doing right now, I never thought this would be part of my destiny before the awakening process. This is something that came through. Like, all of a sudden, I started finding myself talking, speaking these long flowing expanses of, reflective of my realization. And I thought, I better find some place. This must be part of what I'm meant to do as well. And so I need to find a place where I can get that message out, to get that, story out, because I think my own experience might help others. And you know, one of the things that people write me the most, send me emails, which any of you listening there, you're welcome to do. I got some really nice emails from our last show, Greg, and I love it. I love to hear from the people and what they think. And, you know, my email address, cmoores, C-M-O-O-R-S, at creativecosmos.org. Feel free to write me. And some of what I hear is like, you know, somebody wrote me from Ireland once, and they were telling me that they work in an office, and suddenly they started feeling like something's going on, and nobody else seems to get it. And they're a little bit, you know, concerned, or a little bit, you know, they don't know what's going to come next. And then I have the happy job of saying, hey, this is a great thing. This is a wonderful thing. You know, many blessings are about to come upon you. So, you know, have faith, have courage, and move onward. You know, this is going to be really awesome, and you don't even know where it's going to go. It's just going to be, you know, it's, and when we hear, mythical journeys, or, you know, when we enjoy such things as like the Lord of the Rings, or, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia, or, you know, any of these, or, you know, one reason the Harry Potters are popular, or, you know, it's, people sense that there's this magic there behind the scenes, and when they get a taste of it, they love it and they want more. And this magic is really symbolic of the truth of our own life and our own existence. The magic is real, and the magic can be all of ours when we uncover, recover the meaning and the depth of our soul.
So true. Yeah, indeed. I have a couple of quotes I want to read, one of which I think sort of encapsulates some of what you were saying. This is from Joseph Goldstein's Insight Meditation, The Practice of Freedom. He says, when the Buddha described his teaching in the most concise way, he said that he taught one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. Understanding this reality for ourselves frees our mind and opens more fully the possibilities for compassionate action in the world.
Hmm. Yeah.
And the last one, I think, it took me a long time to sort of grasp it, or not grasp it as the case may be.
Yeah.
And this sort of goes to this sort of whole concept of meditation in some respects. This is Li Po. The birds have vanished into the sky, and now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and me, until only the mountain remains.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll mention one other person while we're at it here, before we close up here. Thich Nhat Hanh is another person I didn't mention earlier, who has written many books that are very helpful and very gentle too. You asked earlier about, you know, maybe some gentleness, in embarking upon this journey, and Thich Nhat Hanh really lays out the present moment and the blooming of the lotus and some of the Zen ways of approaching life, that are just very clear, concise, simple, beautiful, and immensely helpful. So I'd highly recommend those books as well.
Yeah, I really enjoyed his Peace is Every Step book. That was phenomenal.
Yeah, he gives some nice things, you know, like, let's say if you're waiting in a line at a grocery store, for instance, you know, rather than getting pissed off and all worked up that, oh, this is taking forever, I gotta get, instead it can become a point of you to become aware. You know, anytime you feel those things rise up in you, you can just stop and be aware. And suddenly you lift right out of that whole scenario, and you can just look around, and it's really incredible actually to find that depth of the moment immersed in people bustling around. It's like time stops for you and you're viewing everything as if from above, and it can be really freaky when you really kind of see people cruising around, and you can almost see what's on their minds and see everything that's going on in deeper and deeper layers, you know. Or the same thing with like come to a stoplight. Instead of, you know, being in such a hurry and cruising on through, you just stop and be aware. Come back to yourself. Because when you're in the mind and you're worrying about what is to come, or you're fretting about what has happened, then you're not in the present. And then when you come to the present, it opens up a plethora of doorways to a myriad of realizations.
Absolutely. Yeah, it reminds me a lot of that. What you said reminded me of that movie, What the Bleep Do We Know, where they talk about, you know, have you ever looked at yourself through the eyes of the ultimate observer?
Yeah, very true. The one looking through each of our eyes is the same.
Very profound. Well, Christopher, it's been a pleasure speaking with you again. Absolutely enjoyed it immensely. I want to give you a chance again to sort of any sort of closing thoughts or information you want to leave with the listeners, your website, or anything at all.
Sure, yeah. As always, you can visit me. My home base is creativecosmos.org. creativecosmos.org. And I write and I draw and I compose music and have a book on there, which I think a few of you who listened to our last podcast actually picked up, because I got some very lovely letters about how the book facilitated some of these kind of awakenings we're talking about. That's the reason I throw so much out there, is because I just want to be a part of that process, you know. If I can help trigger something, that makes me the happiest guy on the planet. So you can feel free to check that out, the book, Pearly Gates Press. And as I said, email me anytime you want, cmores@creativecosmos.org. And join our forum, check out our information center, Soul School, anything that can be helpful. That's why I throw it up there. So, yeah, I'm always happy to hear from you, and love to do the radio. I love it more each time I do it. Enjoy doing this with you, Greg, and love your site, A Cult of Personality. I visit it all the time. There's a link on my site to get to yours, and thank you for having me on and being a partner in this work that we're all undertaking of growth, enlightenment, realization, and bringing as much of this to the light of day as we possibly can.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, it's my pleasure, and I really appreciate the support. And I also enjoy these conversations quite a bit, not just for the fact that it's a fun to speak with you, but I agree that, you know, there's been a lot of positive feedback, and it seems like it's more than just a good time.
Reality is...